access number 27202, Colonel James Dowson, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about your time as a medical student at Leeds University between 1950 and 1956. You did, however, still have a military commitment as a sort of reservist, National Service reservist. Could you tell us what form that took?
Well, it was part-time compulsory military service, and I was obliged to associate with a TA unit, and I naturally chose the Leeds University Training Corps. That's what it was called when I joined. It very soon afterwards became the Leeds University Officers Training Corps. I'm not quite sure how the change took place. It was simply an administrative nominal change as far as I was concerned. We had permanent staff instructors, and it was the usual formation of territorial army units. And these permanent staff instructors gave us instruction in military matters, the usual sort of things that you do in classrooms, loading and unloading weapons, stripping them down, all that kind of thing. And the arrival of a chap called Ernie Marno, who utterly transformed our experience. He was an old hand from the Western Desert, and he was also a tremendously resourceful survivor, as far as he could work out. He told fantastic stories, which we didn't believe, and which were all entirely true. He met an Italian girl in the Western Desert, in one of the Italian colonies there, Tobruk or somewhere like that. Courted her, married her, and then he survived the war. He went with a field ambulance into Europe. Was the field ambulance that was put ahead of the front line into Belsen, and he helped with the clearing of Belsen, and got typhus, as well as being mentioned in dispatches, and recovered in Norway. Came back and joined up with his wife, and then as a kind of reward for long service and good conduct, he would say long service and sort of escape detection of all his misdemeanors, he got this permanent staff instructor place, and they bought a grocery shop on greengrocers, general dealers in Leeds, and instead of drawing rations, which is what we'd done for all our weekend training, he drew cash in lieu and explained to us the advantages of doing so, and then bought all the stuff from his own general dealers, and we went out and cooked it, which taught us how to use the hydro burner, and operated a number 11 shelter, which is a thing that goes on the back of a three tonner, and we built bridges and we made rafts, and we really had an immensely...
Now, were you a basic generic infantry OTC?
No. This was an REMC subunit. He was an REMC warrant officer, WO2.
So this was an REMC part of the Leeds University OTC?
That's right. There was infantry, there was REMI, there was engineers, and there was REMC... there might have been others as well. Artillery, yes, there would be artillery.
And what kind of training would you do when you went out then?
Well, in our case, as I said, we learned the practices of REMC sort of frontline evacuation type of thing, making bridges for transporting stretchers, rafts for transporting stretchers, and This number 11 shelter was a kind of regimental aid post casualty clearing area. They would come in one side. It's on the back of a three-tonner, and it's a kind of loop that goes round, and it's canvas-covered. The stores are in the three-tonner. The working part is behind the three-tonner, and the casualties come in one side and go out the other, and then dispose of into other kinds of accommodation, field accommodation. And he'd done that throughout the war, so he was very well practiced in it, and also very well practiced in looking after himself and teaching us how to look after ourselves using army equipment.
How often would these weekend exercises
about
be?
About once a month, and really quite frequently, and they were very popular. He did excellent recces throughout the Yorkshire Dales, chose the best pubs to go to, and best sites for doing the things that we needed to do, a river to make a raft or to erect a bridge crossing. And he really became quite well known, and various divisional people and, you know, area people came to see this wonder of Verney Marnow. We had generals coming and we laid on a special treat for them, and they came and looked at all this stuff in a great long table set out. Most impressive.
So was he a sergeant? Or?
He was a warrant officer class 2, WO2.
And how do you spell Marnow?
M-A-R-N-O.
As it says. And what, anything, did you have summer camps as well?
Yes, there was a summer camp. I don't really remember them very much. My memory is dominated for summer camps with the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. When I qualified in medicine, I actually went to Glasgow University for a short while and took Ernie Marnow's repertoire up with me and made a great impression upon the OTC up there.
Now, what year did you go to Glasgow University? Was that as a student or as a...
No, it was postgraduate. It would be 1958. And when I got there, the...
And what subject were you... I mean, was it just
normal? It was teaching anatomy.
And we don't need to go into that, but tell us a bit about your role with the OTC there.
Well, I got up there, and the OTC was very much the sort of desultory sit around, have a few drinks, chat, and go home and look at one or two manuals. A kind of token organization. And I was full of explaining all these things about what Ernie Marnow had done with us to them, and they got interested, and I said, I'll show you. So we went up to Glen Coe, and we did all these things. They hadn't actually ever unpacked a hydro burner and a number 11 shelter and things like that, yet they had it all there, and I showed them how to put it up and move around with it. And really, I'm very grateful to Ernie Marnow for doing this, because it aroused their interest and consolidated my own confidence, I suppose, in what I'd learned from him.
Now, can you sketch in your NHS career between sort of you left? Leeds University in April 1956.
Yes, you've got to do a year of provisional registration. It's called, where you did a year in Leeds. And then at the end of that year, did various jobs. One of the jobs was an anatomy demonstrator in Glasgow, which I told you one of the military consequences of that. And then I came back to a rather indeterminate part of my career, which ended up with me doing ophthalmology, which is what I subsequently stuck with and made all my career. And in order to get a definitive job in ophthalmology, it necessitated me moving to Newcastle. Moving away from Leeds, the Glasgow thing was only temporary. Moving away from Leeds meant I had to change TA affiliation, and I became associated as regimental medical officer with the 6th Battalion, the City Battalion of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the commanding officer, it was a TA battalion. The commanding officer was a solicitor by the name of Wood. He was always called Eben. I don't think his name was Ebenezer, but Eb Wood was what he was called. It might have been EB that his initials were. But he was a great fireball of energy and mad on recruiting. Nearly all the officers were... in the legal profession, you might say, solicitors and junior clerks and so on. And he managed to get the battalion, I think, almost up to strength, 750 or thereabouts. So I was very heavily employed in doing recruitment medicals. And we went on summer camps, which were really very enjoyable. There was a tremendous esprit de corps that he managed to drum up in that battalion.
Now, what were you looking for in a medical?
Just physical fitness, really. There's very little else that you can assess. You would spot the, in terms of medical conditions, you might spot someone whose chest wasn't so good, but you rarely came across anyone who was actually ill so that you could turn him down.
And what years were you with the 6th Battalion?
From 1960 until 1962.
And anything else about your time with them? Because, you know, or was it fairly routine, just medicals and...
Medicals and summer camp. And again, really, I suppose the most lasting impression that I come away with is the tremendous feeling that Edward managed to generate to make them a very lively and spirited battalion.
So what happens next then?
Well, this goes right back to when we first started talking. I was in the health service. I got to a senior registrar, not a permanent senior registrar, in the health service, and I hadn't passed any of the exams that are essential to get you onto the shortlist for any further consideration. And I was in competition with a chap called Neil Manson for a senior registrar job, and he got it. And I chose at that time, because Drummond had offered what they called the New Deal in the REMC. Drummond, who was the Director General of Army Medical Services then, had proposed that they raise the standard of qualification and competence of medical officers and paid them appropriately. And that seemed really quite a good deal. And there was I had a young family at the time and had my doubts about that. But the desire to travel seemed to be present in my wife as well as myself. So I joined.
Now, how did you actually go about joining? Was there any particular procedure, or was it fairly...
Yeah, you just apply. You know, dear sir, I'd like to join the REMC. And then you came back and they interviewed down in London and offered me an appointment. And at that time, it was a short service commission that I took. And I went down to Aldershot and to the Cambridge Military Hospital there.
Now, what were you doing at the Cambridge Military
Hospital? I was doing ophthalmology. I met a chap called Pilcher, Dick Pilcher, who was a quiet, unassuming man, and really it was a very different experience. I'd just come back from being a brash and rather arrogant senior registrar in a teaching hospital in the NHS, and came to this hospital where things were fairly quiet, but also attitudes of, you know, unassuming attitudes and modest attitudes were really much more widespread than they are in a teaching hospital. So I said to myself, you know, you really must look at these people and adjust your manners, if you like, and make sure that you don't roll over them. So and that was a lesson in humility, I suppose.
Now tell us a bit about the story.
I think I learned.
Now you joined in 1962. Do you know which month, or doesn't matter too much?
It would be autumn. I can't remember the month. I do remember getting a hiring in Farnborough and to bring my wife and three children down. And she was expressing some doubts, and I said, oh, don't worry, mild weather down in the south. And we went down round about Christmas time, and on Boxing Day it started to snow. Boxing Day 1962, and the snow and frost eventually cleared sometime towards the end of April. It was the winter of 63 that we hit the south.
Now, what was your hired accommodation like? That was hired for you by the army, was it?
It was a hiring. I sought it myself, and this is one of the discoveries I made with the short service commission. You get very few privileges. There were lots of privileges offered to medical officers in order to induce them to join, and I thought all of these applied to every medical officer, but they don't. First of all, there's a division between those applying for a permanent commission and those having a short service commission. You weren't entitled to a quarter with a short service commission. You had to go and look for accommodation yourself. And I found this hiring by just searching around. You got the allowances all right, but none of those attachments of quarters. And that was always a big bone of contention, a thing that retarded medical officers from joining. They or anybody from joining. If you didn't have accommodation for your married people, if you didn't have an accommodation for your family, then you tended not to go in.
Now, what about your work in ophthalmology? Sorry.
A lot of that was
about what sort of work it was, because people don't know.
Well, I discovered to my consternation that you had to do a lot of supplying soldiers with glasses prescriptions, which I didn't really regard as ophthalmology at the time, because that was all done by opticians in the hospitals. Ophthalmology was the clinical part, the operative and medical ophthalmology. The most of the operations that we did would concern the families, because they were young people. There wasn't very much in the way of cataract or older person's eye diseases, and so it would be squints in children. That's by a long way the commonest thing I dealt with. The other kind of diseases that afflict young adults, inflammatory eye diseases and so on. And there were also standards of visual acuity that you had to record regularly, so there would be masses of troops going through to have their visual acuity recorded and refractions done and so on.
Did you enjoy the work? Or was it not very challenging?
Wasn't all that challenging. What I enjoyed was, I suppose, a new experience. And then quite soon after I was there, I got a posting to Singapore.
So
that was very exciting.
63?
63, yes.
Where were you posted to in Singapore?
Well, there was only the one posting for me, and that was British Military Hospital in Alexandria, which is a district of Singapore. And was the military district, if you like. It was masses and masses of army quarters. Although it touched on the town, and BMH Singapore, I thought was really quite exciting.
And you were there as an ophthalmologist?
That's right, ophthalmologist.
Sorry, I don't know why I can't say that today. It was all right yesterday. And how did, what about, did you take your family with you? Of course.
Yes, we all went out together. Again, you see, it was because of that dreadful winter of 63, we departed on, I think it was Thursday, before Easter, in a raging snowstorm from Stansted. And we lost Good Friday somewhere over the Indian Ocean. And the first experience I had of this kind of travel was when the doors opened, and it was Britannia, the doors opened in Bombay, and I thought we were stepping into a coffee roaster, but it wasn't, it was just a normal temperature. And then we got used to this, or we got to realise that it wasn't going to get cooler, and we got to Singapore, I had my overcoat with the sleeves tied together, all the heavy winter clothing from my family wrapped up in this thing on my shoulder, and the kids, the three children, and well, there were four children then, all covered with sweat and grime, deposited on Singapore, and experiencing this hot and humid atmosphere, which is what we'd never get over. It was exhausting.
How long did it take to acclimatise to the heat?
About 6 months. That is, I'll explain that a bit later on. We were met by a chap called Bill Craig, who was an old army hand and had been an eye specialist. That's easier to say. for many years in the army, and he was immaculately dressed in smooth ironed shorts and shirt, and looked cool and smart, and we were looking terribly disreputable and soggy and damp. And I looked at him in disbelief. I thought, people can't look like that in this heat. But he did, and eventually we did, of course. But because we had none of the privileges of a permanent commission, we were stuck in a hotel for a while, and we had to find our own accommodation, which we did.
Was it good accommodation? I mean, you know.
Yes. It was done. This is where I experienced the sort of attitudes of the Far East, attitudes that were completely foreign to me. In order to get anything done in the Far East, in Singapore, you had to find somebody who was a fixer. And this fixer would say, yes, I'll find a place for you. And then he'd ring you up and say, come and look at this. So you didn't have to sort of get the papers and look through all the classified ads or anything. You just got this fixer. And my wife's brother-in-law, my wife's sister's husband, was one of a family who were mariners. And his brother, called Harold, was a captain in the Straits Steamship Company based in Singapore, and he had a wife who was local called Edith, and we met them, and they said, what you need is a fixer, and introduced us to this procedure. And the fixer went and showed us directed us towards a few places, and we selected one, and it was fine. It was all subsidized in the ordinary way, but there were no whereas if I'd had a permanent commission, I'd just marched into a quarter. In the case of having a short service commission, that was left to me. And as it happened, it was probably a good thing.
Now, what about your family and their education and things like that?
There were British schools. They'd gone to school in Farnborough, and then they went to school in Singapore.
Were you worried it might disrupt their education?
We were, but we met people who reassured us. There was one chap who was actually a primary school head in Sunderland, and he said he'd worked in RAF schools previously, and he said in his experience the frequent changes of school rarely did children any harm, as long as they were receptive to education. I suppose that was a condition he didn't mention. But, you know, if you've got a child who's reasonably happy with accepting schooling, the changes didn't make any difference. And I think our experience bore that out. In the long run, it didn't make an awful lot of difference to them. Well, if there was any difference at all, it was slightly beneficial. For instance, when they finally settled down at school in Darlington, Toby, that's our youngest, got the reputation so that when the teacher was talking about far-off lands, she would say, she told us on a parents' evening, whenever I mention somewhere, Toby always says he's been there. And he had, usually. So, it's travel that been an extra dimension to their education. Right. That's perhaps the way to put it. Changing schools doesn't hamper their education in the way that people worry about, and in ways that they don't think of, it actually adds an extra dimension to their education.
Now, what was your job like there as an eye specialist?
Well, it's very similar. Largely families, and I also made contacts with the Singapore General Hospital ophthalmic staff and went and did some clinics there because there was time to do it. And I also had to travel. It was a travelling job, and I used to go all the way up to Penang and doing clinics on the way. And also, I actually went to Hong Kong and shared that. There was another eye specialist at RAF Changi, and a chap called Daly, Tony Daly. And between us, we used to do Hong Kong, because there was no eye specialist in Hong Kong, no military eye specialist in Hong Kong. So it was quite a fair bit of travelling to do.
But the same essential problems.
Yes.
Squints, the rest of the
squints in children, family problems, and medicals.
Did you deal with any of the local population?
I did, yes. We did in Hong Kong and in Singapore, but always and never independently. It wasn't like sort of going out and doing something among the natives, as it were, because there were no natives. It's a really sophisticated society, and what you did was you associated yourself with the local specialists who accepted you as a colleague and give you some responsibilities depending on how they thought of you.
How were they treating squints at the time? It seems to have been the, you know, just as an example.
Oh, pretty well standard treatment. You treat the lazy eye by patching and making them use it, and glasses to correct any optical error, and operation to get them straight. And that was the way I did it. I was really quite keen on early and energetic treatment of squint, and I had completely free hand, no one to argue with or anything like that. I just had to do it myself, and really I enjoyed that quite a lot.
And you felt it was successful, you know, it's straighten them up.
Oh yes, and getting them straight nice and early, and lots of little sort of reassuring anecdotes that I could tell you about how successful it was. The Vietnam War and the Vietnam commitment and confrontation and so on were mounting at that time. Australians came and occupied a large part of a military camp called Terendak near Malacca, and I used to see a lot of them. The British forces were once confrontation ended, which was around about the time I left, the British forces were since they could predict it was going to end, they were on the point of contracting, and Wilson was on the point of pulling everybody out of the Far East and leaving it to the Australians and other people closer at hand.